Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 29th of January, these are our main stories. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promises a strong, swift and precise response to a deadly attack on an East Jerusalem synagogue. The former NATO general and staunch EU supporter Petr Pavel has been elected president in the Czech Republic. Also,
I think at its peak in 1 hour, we saw more than 71 millimetres of rain. And usually it's just 6 millimetres is enough for forecasters to deem the rain heavy. That just shows you how intense it really was here in Auckland.
A state of emergency in New Zealand's largest city as it's deluged with months of rain in just one day. And in this podcast, can AI replace journalists? Why reporting unpatriotic neighbours and relatives is back in fashion in Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Any people, particularly the Russian people, can always tell true patriots from scum and traitors.
Plus, can Italy's Appian Way gain World Heritage Site status? The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says there will be a strong, swift and precise response to two shootings in East Jerusalem. A Palestinian gunman killed 7 people near a synagogue hours before a 13-year-old boy wounded a father and son. The child suspect was himself shot and is in hospital. In recent weeks, dozens of Palestinians have been killed during Israeli raids in villages and refugee camps. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolan Nell, reports on an upsurge of violence not seen for many years.
Gunshots again in Jerusalem, this time in Silwan, a tense neighbourhood just below the walled old city where Jewish settlers live next to Palestinians. An Israeli father and son were injured, shot by a 13-year-old. Local media say the suspect was close to another boy who just died after being shot earlier in the week by Israeli police. The shooting came hours after last night's attack, the deadliest Israelis have seen in years. At the start of the Jewish Sabbath, a 21-year-old Palestinian opened fire as worshippers left a packed synagogue. He was chased and shot dead by police. Tonight, at a security cabinet meeting, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promised to take strong action in response.
I'll submit to the security cabinet additional steps in the fight against terrorism. This includes significantly hastening and expediting the licensing of weapons for authorised civilians. As we've seen time and time again, this saves lives.
On the streets of Jerusalem, emotions are running high. Israelis have been blocking cars in Palestinian neighbourhoods. Meanwhile, Palestinian leaders in the West Bank said they held the Israeli government fully responsible for the dangerous escalation. The synagogue shooting came a day after Israel's military killed 9 people in the West Bank in its most deadly raid there for years, prompting Palestinian militants in Gaza to fire rockets at Israel. International concerns now growing about the spiralling violence.
Yolan Nell. The US, EU, Russia and Saudi Arabia have joined the UN in warning against escalating unrest. With his thoughts, here's our international editor, Jeremy Bone.
The sad truth is that many predicted the upsurge in killing on the scale that's happened in the last few days in Jenin and Jerusalem. It's the result of a generations-long conflict that is tumbling into a much deeper crisis. The handshakes and hopes for peace of the 1990s are a distant memory. Even then, killings happened, and when they did, American diplomats would swoop in. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was already coming to Jerusalem next week. But for years, there's been no peace process to revive. The international consensus has been that the only way to make peace is to establish a Palestinian state alongside Israel. But those hopes are meaningless as things stand. The Palestinians are divided and a new generation is being radicalised. As for the Israeli government, the new one is the most ultra-nationalist since the state was established in 1948. It has declared that Jews have the exclusive and unquestionable right to all areas of the land of Israel, which includes the area Palestinians want for a state.
Jeremy Bowen. The people of the Czech Republic have decided who their next president will be, Petr Pavel, a former NATO general and supporter of the European Union. His job is mostly ceremonial, but highly influential, and the final weeks of the campaign were ill-tempered and marred by disinformation. Mr. Pavel at one point had to deny rumours of his own death. But in the runoff vote, he comfortably defeated his rival, the oligarch Andrej Babiš. Here's part of his victory speech.
I see that values won in this election. Values such as truth, dignity, respect and humility. I'm convinced that these values are shared by the vast majority of us and that it is definitely worth trying to make them part of our daily lives, and they must also make a return to our politics.
Our correspondent in Prague is Rob Cameron. I asked him whether there was a great deal of division in Czech society.
There really is, yes, and that's come to the fore during this election campaign, and it's at least partly because Mr. Babiš, former prime minister, billionaire, businessman, is an extremely divisive character. He's obviously hugely rich, he's influential, but he's also extremely abrasive. He attacks the media. He's quite fierce in his condemnation of his opponents. His public rallies are marked by large counter-rallies. They become very noisy affairs with people trying to shout him down and so on. So this country, I think, is divided. Yes, this victory by Petr Pavel is significant. It's impressive. 58% have given him quite an endorsement, but certainly General Pavel does have a lot of work ahead to heal some of those divisions that do exist in Czech society.
So what is his appointment likely to mean, do you think, particularly with the war in Ukraine?
Well, I think this is pretty important for the Czech Republic's support for the war in Ukraine. Obviously, there has been speculation in recent months that rising energy prices and the cost of living crisis would begin to erode the support of people across Europe, in Central Europe, in countries like the Czech Republic, Slovakia and so on, for their government's very muscular support of Ukraine's war effort. I think this is an affirmation that no, this country lies firmly behind Kyiv in its battle against the Russian invasion, and it is absolutely sure that this is a country that is anchored in the West, that is an active part, an active member of the European Union and of NATO. So I think that's how we should see this election. To those who were worried that perhaps this country was beginning to drift in a different direction, this is confirmation that that is not the case.
Rob Cameron. There are conflicting reports of attacks from both Russia and Ukraine in the east of Ukraine. Russia says the Ukrainians have attacked a hospital in the occupied Luhansk region, killing 14 people. Meanwhile, in the city of Kostyantynivka in Donetsk, several people have been reported dead after residential buildings and a hotel were attacked by Russia. Local residents left the destroyed building and bombing as fighting approaches the town of Chasiv Yar, also in Donetsk.
We were in the apartment. We lied on the ground, then the projectile hit. It destroyed everything. We are left without a place to live. That's enough. No more.
I have no neighbours. How should I live? I don't know. I have lived an honest life. This damned war.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, told me more about what's going on.
The main incident we're looking at the moment is an attack on the village of Novoaidar, which is in an occupied area of Luhansk. There's two different accounts. So the Russian Ministry of Defense are saying it was attacked in the morning by the Ukraine using American HIMARS rockets. It hit a district hospital. There are pictures of a building with a shattered roof and concrete debris. Clearly quite a serious attack. The Ministry of Defense in Moscow says 14 people were killed, 24 injured, and that included civilians and military as well as medical personnel. There's a different account from the Ukrainian governor of Luhansk. He says that the building was struck by Ukrainian forces. They coincide on that, but that dozens of Russian forces died in the attack. We haven't had independent confirmation. It's in a very active zone. We do know that there's a Ukrainian counteroffensive going on close to that region in an area called Kremina. The other attack, which is in a Ukrainian-held territory in a town called Kostiantynivka, that is a town about 20 kilometres southwest of Bakhmut, and there's images of shattered windows on sort of five-storey residential buildings. And the local Ukrainian governor there says that three people were killed and a number of people were injured.
And what does this tell us about the overall situation in this war? Because the suggestion is we're seeing a surge in fighting.
Well, we're seeing different things. So, as I say, in Luhansk, it's a Ukrainian counteroffensive trying to cut Russian supply lines. In Donetsk, what you're seeing is increasing pressure on towns like Bakhmut. The fighting is very, very serious. President Zelensky has spoken of the fact it's extremely acute and that the Russians are destroying systematically towns and villages with artillery strikes, air strikes and offensives on the ground.
Danny Aberhard. In the US city of Memphis, the Scorpion Police Unit has been disbanded. Five of its members have been charged with murder after video footage showed them kicking and beating a black man called Tyree Nichols, who died in hospital 3 days later. Scorpion stood for Street Crimes Operations to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods and was deployed to areas that were considered to be crime hotspots. As further peaceful protests took place, we asked some people there what they thought.
We can't continue to allow anyone to suffer from police brutality. And these officers cross the line. It's not a white-black matter. It's a human life matter.
Police, the institution of them, says that divide yourself from the people. So they don't get an opportunity to see people in their holistic being. They are concerned about, I am superior.
I hate it, man. Like, I'm real iffy about my own city right now.
Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher is in Memphis. I asked her what else people are saying.
So there are some questions around the conduct of the police, especially why they were so aggressive and beat Mr. Nichols so badly when he hadn't even been resisting. Having said that, those journalists who monitor these things and see videos that are not as publicly released say it doesn't look that different from what they've seen before. It was the fact that he died that brought it to light in this way. They also comment on the fact that as well as the brutality of what we're seeing, it shows the poor training of the police. And then, of course, some people that we spoke to here said they didn't need to watch it. They already knew that police brutality was rampant.
Do you think this could have an impact on policing across the US, in particular, the training of police?
Yes, it might, because it is a national problem. But you did have changes instituted across the nation in states and cities after George Floyd's murder in 2020. There were things like bans on chokeholds and restrictions on the use of force and requirements that officers wear cameras. But those steps have fallen short of dealing with the problems. There is a greater attention, I think, to things like training and bias and mental health. You have steps here in Memphis of local politicians planning to introduce legislation in the Tennessee legislature around that. And you have seen a difference in how the authorities respond. In this case, they have moved faster than many have in the past, and they've also very carefully prepared the public for what they were going to see in that video.
And how much is race part of this debate?
Well, it's a part of it for sure. The stats and the experience of people show that police culture is biased against black and brown people. And you even notice here in Memphis, which is a majority black city with a majority black police force, that police used force against black residents nearly three times more frequently than white residents in recent years. Also, if you look at people who follow this quite closely, one or two have said that when they track police violence, they never found that the race of the officer made much difference. It is more an issue of who is apprehended and how.
Barbara Plett-Usher. It's amazing what artificial intelligence can do. Compose music, write in the style of Shakespeare, read audiobooks, pass law exams. And now the online magazine BuzzFeed says it's going to use an AI program called ChatGPT to write content. Technology writer Kate Bevan spoke to Justin Webb and Martha Carney, who began by asking how easy it would be for AI to write articles for journalists.
I think BuzzFeed might come a cropper with this, mostly because ChatGPT is great at doing pattern matching, at coming up with knowing what's next sentence, but it's not an expert, it's not a sub-editor, it's not an editor, it can't do nuance and context. So what you need at the moment with something like ChatGPT doing that is humans to keep tabs on it. And if BuzzFeed is going to take humans out of the equation, then that's where the problems will come. And one of the things we worry about with AI creating content like this is what's called hallucination, where it completely confidently turns out something that's absolute nonsense. And again, if you haven't got humans moderating that, then you could be in trouble.
Well, our producer got it to write an intro to the BBC's Today programme. And if you can see it there, Justin, but it goes a bit like this. Good morning and welcome to the BBC's Today programme. I'm presenter's name, and joining me in the studio this morning is guest's name. This morning we'll be discussing the latest development in the ongoing current news topic. We'll be hearing from expert/politician/journalist.
That exactly underlines what you've just said. On the one hand, it's perfectly plausible, but actually when you're doing your job at your best, the newspapers I got here are written by people who are trying to write something more interesting than that.
I always find when I look at something written by ChatGPT, it's good at doing voices, getting the tone right, but it's not got the expertise, it's not got the nuance, it's not got the context, and that is where humans are going to stay, I think, I hope.
And will it be more personalised? Because that's one of the reasons that BuzzFeed are saying for giving this. The CEO said readers would be invited to pick a trope for your rom-com or tell us an endearing flaw you have. It's hyper-personalised news, isn't it?
It could be, but what it's not is it's not trained on that hyper-personalised stuff. At the moment, it's trained on the internet. What I think is going to happen next is that companies are going to start training it on their own knowledge bases, their own corpus of work, and then it will become more specific and potentially more worrying for the likes of us.
And then in law offices, I mean, I was talking to management consultants last week who were thinking of how it would be useful in documents where actually the style doesn't terribly matter, but there are certain things that have to be there and be approved and certain words that need to be there. That's where it works.
I think that's where it's going to be really interesting, actually, because what it can do is generate good human comprehensible summaries of arcane, difficult, obscure material. And that's where it's going to be trained on internal knowledge bases and deployed internally in companies.
Do you think we need to know when something's been composed by a chatbot or not?
Very much so. And I think this is one of the things we're going to have to start thinking about is what is the ethical use of this? How transparent do we need to be with it?
Kate Bevan speaking there to Martha Carney and Justin Webb. Still to come on the Global News podcast, we meet the teenage horse racing sensation who just can't stop winning.
Since I've been about 13, I've been riding out before school. I used to have racing ponies, so I was probably up at 5, 6, ride a racing pony in the dark, then go and ride out 2 or 3 racehorses for Dad before school.
Just a few days into his premiership and Chris Hipkins is already dealing with a major disaster in New Zealand. A recovery operation is underway in Auckland, with torrential rain causing flash flooding. At least 3 people have died and the city is under a state of emergency for 6 more days. One man said the water in his house was so high that it went up to his neck. Mr. Hipkins, who became the new Prime Minister of New Zealand on Wednesday following Jacinda Ardern's resignation, said the floods were unprecedented.
The Met Service has confirmed that yesterday was Auckland's wettest day on record. And having just surveyed some of the extensive damage, both on the ground and in the air, it's clear that it's going to be a big clean-up job. For now, our focus is on making sure that we support Aucklanders through this.
Corazon Miller, a journalist based in Auckland, described the conditions there to Alex Ritson.
Scenes like this are unlike anything I've ever seen before here in Auckland, and it happened just so fast. We pulled some data and it showed that this really was an unprecedented record-breaking amount of rain. In 24 hours, the city saw around 245 millimetres of rain, which smashed the previous record of just around 161 back in 1985. I think at its peak in 1 hour, we saw more than 71 millimetres of rain fall. And usually it's just 6 millimetres is enough for forecasters to deem the rain to be heavy. So that just shows you how intense it truly was here in Auckland.
And it's hit some of the most famous sites of Auckland, hasn't it?
Yes, so I work for TVNZ, our own TV presenter today. She fronted the bulletin from Auckland Domain, which is right in the middle of the city. And you could see that there was this immense flood of water. There were children playing in it. There were dogs out there. There were ducks. Usually that's a big, full green park and people are usually walking there, but it was just full of water today. And if you didn't know that she was at the Domain, you would have wondered where was this beautiful new lake that she was standing in front of.
An ankle-deep water in the airport, in the terminal.
Yes, that was crazy. I myself was meant to be on a plane this morning, but all those flights were cancelled. I've never seen the airport flooded before, but it completely filled both the domestic and the international airport, and flights were cancelled, and we've had hundreds, if not maybe thousands of people that have had to stay there overnight as the various airlines and the airports try to clean up the damage, but also just get the flights back in the air safely.
Presumably, climate change will be a factor in this.
Well, yes, I spoke to an infrastructure expert today who indicated that this is something that we are going to have to be prepared for. And Auckland's roads, while we've got some particular challenges in terms of how a lot of these roads are built in hills and around cliffside areas, it is time for people to collectively look at ideas around how we can future-proof our infrastructure. Because if this is going to happen on a regular basis, what happened yesterday virtually shut the entire city down. We had the motorways closed in the north and the south and the east. People simply couldn't travel. We saw cars left in knee waist-deep water. And even today, driving around, I've seen many cars being towed that were clearly too damaged to retrieve today. So it's definitely something that's on a lot of people's minds as well.
Corazon Miller speaking to Alex Ritson. In the darkest days of repression in the Soviet Union, ordinary citizens reported each other to the authorities for criticism of the Communist Party. In Vladimir Putin's Russia, once the largest and most powerful country in the Union of Soviet Republics, this Stalinist practice is experiencing a revival. But now it targets people criticising the war in Ukraine. BBC Monitoring's Russia editor Vitaly Shevchenko looks at the parallels.
Stalin's propaganda was cheerful. Life has become better. Life has become happier, is the refrain of this song, based on a quote from Stalin himself. He said it as his campaign of terror and repression was gathering pace. As a result of this campaign, millions were jailed, sent to labour camps, and hundreds of thousands died. Some of the victims were reported to the authorities, but their neighbours, friends, even parents and their own children. Their alleged crimes included anti-communism, counter-revolutionary activities and corruption. Speaking at the height of the Great Terror, one key official in Stalin's government, Anastas Mikoyan, gave the example of one teenage boy who reported his own father for allegedly stealing state property.
He asked secret police to execute his own father as an enemy of the people. This is the kind of people we have. They are our power and might.
Now in Vladimir Putin's Russia, this practice is enjoying a revival, with people reporting each other for the offence of criticising his special military operation in Ukraine. For example, in Siberia, a father reported his son to the police for allegedly discrediting the Russian armed forces. And in Moscow, another father reported his daughter. Also in the Russian capital, a 10-year-old schoolgirl was taken from the classroom to a police station after the headmaster had reported her for using a social media profile picture in the colours of the Ukrainian flag. At other schools, pupils reported their teachers to the police for criticising the war in Ukraine. None have been jailed yet, but some have had to leave their jobs. I asked historian Sergei Radchenko whether this phenomenon had anything to do with what was going on under Stalin.
I think so. And this practice, of course, goes not just back to Joseph Stalin, but it's a broader Soviet practice, and not just Soviet practice. It's very common in dictatorial authoritarian regimes to report on your neighbors, sometimes even your friends. But there was something to Soviet reporting that did reflect modernity that the Soviet Union was trying to create, where the state knew everything about everyone else. And that idea of an all-knowing, all-seeing state almost by default incorporates reporting on one's neighbors.
Not unlike Stalin, Vladimir Putin also wants Russia to cleanse itself of enemies of the people.
Any people, particularly the Russian people, can always tell true patriots from scum and traitors, and it will spit them out like a fly, spit them out on the floor.
President Putin has described the breakup of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. But now, one aspect of Soviet life is evidently making a comeback.
Vitaly Shevchenko. And also to a period in history that has parallels with Stalinism and still resonates today, the convulsions caused by the Cultural Revolution in China. A new book examines its importance and its connection to present-day China and is full of stories of those who took part in the revolution and what it's cost them. Razia Iqbal spoke to the author Tanya Branigan, who was The Guardian's Beijing correspondent from 2008 to 2015, and asked what the Cultural Revolution was.
It begins in 1966 when Mao unleashes it. 2 million people die, tens of millions of people hounded. And one of the reasons it's so hard to understand is that it's two things at once. It's Mao's, after a period where he's lost credibility and authority with the disaster of his Great Leap Forward, which led to this devastating famine, which saw tens of millions of people die. It's about him reasserting his absolute political authority and eradicating opposition. But the way he does that, and which is different, is that he enlists the masses, and particularly young people, and we're talking kids in many cases. They become this political vigilante force, the Red Guards, and they turn on their teachers, they turn on officials. We see some of the country's greatest thinkers and scholars dying in the uproar. And then it all begins to sort of spiral even further out of control, and between the Red Guards, they turn upon each other. We see not only the deaths of Mao's two heirs apparent, but also entire families being wiped out in some cases in the countryside because they may have been designated as landlords, even babies being murdered.
Your book is called Red Memory, Living, Remembering and Forgetting China's Cultural Revolution. Let's talk about the title, because the living, remembering and forgetting it is a really critical part of what you're trying to explore.
What really fascinated me, I think, was the way that the Cultural Revolution feels as if it's everywhere and nowhere in China. And you really can't understand the country unless you understand what happened in that era, because it's really the break point between Maoism and this turn to the market and reform and opening up, where you turn from this very kind of rigid socialist system towards a much more individualistic era. But at the same time, even though it seemed to be sort of ever-present in every story I did, it's not something that's widely discussed. It's not completely taboo, but the authorities very carefully police discussions of it, and it's become more and more a restricted topic of discussion. Many survivors simply won't speak of it, even with members of their family.
And yet you have drawn portraits of people who were willing to talk to you about it.
The one thing that unites all the people in my book are people who've chosen to remember when other people have all chosen to forget. For many people, it is this sense of guilt, of wanting to understand what they did and why they did it and acknowledge that, of perhaps trying to make amends in some way, a fear that it could return in some form. Those instincts are there. But there's also an immense nostalgia for the Cultural Revolution. And that's one of the fascinating and sort of disturbing things about it, I suppose. There's a Red Guard who thinks essentially that the worst thing about the Cultural Revolution is that it ended. After the initial sort of uprising with the Red Guards, we then saw this period where 17 million teenagers were sent to the countryside, and they thought they were going there for life, not just about going a long way from their parents, but really going almost back a century in terms of living conditions, this incredibly grueling situation that Xi Jinping, the country's leader himself, endured for around 7 years. And they talk about it as being this bitter time. It's so miserable that you can hardly bear to think about it. But they still say, well, we can't say that we regret it, and we can't say that we don't regret it. And they're sort of caught in this inability to understand what it was, partly because it's so little addressed.
Tanya Branigan speaking there to Razia Iqbal. A marble bust of a man, a rare coin from the year 700, and a signet ring from around 100 years earlier than that are all treasures displayed this week by archaeologists in Rome. But what they've been seeking is the start of the legendary Appian Way, a route that the Italian government hopes will be granted World Heritage status from UNESCO. Rebecca Marston has more.
The Appian Way is one of the world's oldest and most famous roads. Built in the 4th century BC, this strategic highway for the Roman Empire runs for more than 500 kilometres between Rome and the southern port city of Brindisi. It's a route trodden by legendary figures such as Julius Caesar and St Peter. Since then, it has become rather, you might say, downtrodden. now sitting at a level some historical documents put at 8 metres deep. Archaeologist Daniel Manaconda says there's much to discover.
Se noi potessimo scendere ancora, troveremmo il paesaggio della Roma arcaica.
If we could go further down, we would find the landscape of ancient Rome, then the landscape of imperial Rome, the one made of monuments, but also of houses, the antique Rome that lived off the remains of what came before.
Italy's existing clutch of World Heritage sites include entire historical city centres, such as Rome, Florence and Venice, and totals 58, the most of any country. While the Appian Way waits to hear whether it can officially add to this total, the digging will carry on in the bid to uncover quite where this, the world's first superhighway, actually begins.
Rebecca Marston. Billy Lockton is a name you probably don't know, but the horse racing world is talking of pretty much no one else. He's already won a lot of races this year, making him the leading flat jockey in Britain. And he's still only 16. Our sports correspondent, Laura Scott, has been to meet him.
He's too young to drive a car, but 16-year-old Billy Lochnan doesn't need wheels. He rides racehorses at 40 miles an hour and is taking the flat racing world by storm, with more than 20 winners this month alone.
It's extraordinary. It's just kind of taken off, really, and look, none of us expected it to happen, so it's amazing.
Since his first ride in November, he's earned more than £100,000 in prize money.
I started riding out when I was 10 or 11, and then since I've been about 13, I've been riding out before school. I used to have racing ponies, so I was probably up at 5, 6, ride a racing pony in the dark, then go and ride out 2 or 3 racehorses for Dad before school, so...
I mean, it's quite a different life to a lot of people your age.
Yeah, it's a bit different, but look, I was always driven and it was what I was wanting to do, so it was just part of the plan, really.
Most of his winners have been for his dad, Mark.
Okay. Christmas present was a rocking horse. Then I bought my pony and his second one, and he's not been off them since.
But his rapid rise has got the biggest names in the sport circling.
Has the phone been ringing off the hook?
Yeah, which is a good complaint, because when the phone stops ringing, you're getting worried. But for a young chap who's only riding 12 weeks, to get rides like this, it's unheard of, really. For us, as a family, watching him doing what he's doing, it's just unbelievable.
Billy, I know you're only just starting out, but what are your ultimate ambitions as a jockey?
This year, my main goal is to be champion apprentice, and for the future, champion jockey. I know it's a long way off. It's going to take a lot of hard work, and then if the right horse come along to win a derby as well, it would be amazing. But look, a lot of luck's got to happen for that.
Despite the hype, the teenager is somehow keeping his feet on the ground. Well, when they're not in the stirrups. But while the winners keep coming, Billy the Kid is riding the crest of a wave.
Laura Scott on Billy Lochnan. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Darren Garnett. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.